There are a lot of folks who are being impacted by our individual decisions who never signed up for the consequences of those decisions that we each individually make. And I think that that's unusual. Obviously, there are plenty of situations where the decisions that we make as individuals impact others. Decision whether to, all the way from driving while intoxicated to, the choices we make in what we choose to buy, what we choose to do, all the individual choices we make. But I think, pandemic, because there's so many nonlinear effects, where everybody being cautious can have a greatly disproportionate positive impact, and everyone being uncautious can have a greatly disproportionate negative effect on our entire society. The virus doesn't have any political belief one way or the other. It just, it's a strand of RNA, and that's all it is, right? It replicates or it doesn't replicate. The meme of the honey badger don't care, right? The coronavirus don't care.
Over three decades, Matt Cohen has worked in venture capital and technology strategy. He's advised many investors and companies, helping them strategize their technology and products. Any other point in time, we would be talking with Matt about his work. This time, Matt joins John and Scoop to talk about his contracting COVID-19 and his long recovery.
Hey, this is the Plutopia News Network again, and I'm here with Scoop Sweeney, my partner in crime. You can find us at plutopia.io online. We have a Plutopia News Network Facebook page that you can find, and we do a live stream there on Thursday nights, in addition to the podcast here. And you can find us on Twitter as @Plutopia. And today our guest is Matt Cohen. Matt's a consultant, a strategist, and an investor based in Austin. He's got over 30 years of experience in tech and business strategy and venture capital and online media. We're talking to Matt today, though, not so much about business, but about his experience with his recent experience and continued experience with COVID-19. Hello, Matt.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Yeah. Welcome. Happy to see you. Hadn't seen you in a while, actually.
Oh, well, I think a lot of people haven't seen a lot of people.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We're all sheltering in place. And you probably have had more reason than some of us, because you have actually been dealing with your own case of COVID-19.
Absolutely.
So how did you figure out that you had COVID-19?
Sure. So, like many folks who are information workers, I've been working from home since the beginning of March. Early on in the pandemic, I really limited my contact extremely. I, rarely went out. Occasionally when I went to the grocery store, I would wear a mask, I would wear gloves, I would use hand sanitizer, try and wipe down the shopping cart. My children's school went remote or was canceled. And so, I figured that my risk was actually quite low. In general, my health has been pretty good. And then in mid-June, all of a sudden, I started getting a fever. I guess this was on around June 12th. I got a fever. And sort of body chills, sort of like when you have the flu. Felt pretty tired. Went to bed and kind of had those symptoms for probably less than 24 hours. By the end of the next day, I was maybe feeling a little bit tired, but otherwise basically okay. And then I basically had no symptoms for about a week. Like I said, except maybe for feeling a little bit tired, but it it's hard to tell. And then about a week later, I started having some trouble breathing. You know, I've had allergies off and on in my life, not as much lately, but a lot when I was in my teens, 20s, 30s. And so it was, you know, kind of similar to bronchitis initially, you know, coughing, tightness in my chest. Called up my primary care physician and did a telemedicine appointment. And he had me go in to get, well, let me see, let me make sure I'm doing this in the right order. Actually, I'm doing this a little bit in the wrong order. So that this was on, I think, on a Friday when I got this fever. And then my son had his, my son who's less than 10, had his annual checkup scheduled for the following Monday. And I figured, well, you know, I don't think I have COVID because I've hardly been around anybody. But just in case, I probably should get tested because I don't want to, you know, take my child into his well check if I'm not well. So called up my primary care physician and he had me go get a test. And the only, I actually had to drive up to Round Rock, Texas, about a half an hour drive from Central Austin, where I live. And I got the nasal swab and figured it wouldn't be anything, but I was just being careful and being cautious. And then I got a call back the following day that I found out that it was positive. So that's kind of when the symptoms at that point, like I said, had gone away. And then about a week later is when I started having these respiratory symptoms. And my physician had me go in and get a chest x-ray. And then, and the, I, out of all of the Austin Radiological Associates imaging centers in Austin, there was exactly one that was for known or suspected COVID cases. And it was very interesting to be in an environment where it was kind of like being out of you know, a pandemic movie, where everybody was completely covered head to toe with protective gear. They had me put on an extreme, you know, a very, very heavy duty, you know, N95 mask. I didn't go into any of the main waiting rooms. They had me go down a hallway in the office building, in the medical office tower building where it was, to a room that had been specifically set up just to do chest x-rays. They, you know, they had you go in only one at a time. There were two medical technicians in there, one to sort of do the prep work, one to run the x-ray machine, which had been moved into this room, which clearly was normally some sort of office. And the technicians there were incredibly professional, kind, you know, understanding, great communicator. So I got the chest x-ray and it came back with the result that the lower portion of my lungs had become filled with fluid. I'd say my recollection is maybe about maybe a third of my lungs were filled with fluid. So what I went on Amazon and I ordered an oxygen monitor. Now there are two main. A, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, was it a pulse ox or a spirometer?
So in this case, it was a pulse oximeter.
Okay.
There's sort of two kinds that you can get. There's the kind that you have almost certainly gotten if you go to the hospital or a doctor, where it just kind of clips onto the end of your finger. Those typically run about $20 to $30 for a home grade, not a medical grade one. But in my case, I really wanted to monitor my oxygen level for a longer period of time. So there's another kind of pulse oximeter that you can get that that you wear for longer periods of time. So some of them come. There's kind of a ring that goes around your finger, and some of them, the actual monitoring hardware attaches to that. Some of them, there's a cord that attaches the monitoring hardware, the ring, to the actual rest of the equipment that runs, that you wear around your wrist. I wound up getting the kind that you put on your finger. But I think actually, after looking at a lot of them are made by the same manufacturers. And that was a real help. It actually helped, you know, enabled me to monitor my condition. And I'd say, you know, my oxygen level was probably generally around 95%, with dips down to 93%, 94%.
And anything 95 or above is considered okay, right?
That's right. So I was, you know, I was not in, you know, I was definitely worse off than a lot of folks, but way better than many. And I'd say probably the first week was really when I was worried that I might have to go to the hospital. There are definitely some times where, you know, my chest was very tight. I felt like I was, you know, really having to work to breathe. Now, I have, you know, genetically, I have a predisposition to sleep apnea. And so for probably a decade, I've used a constant positive airway pressure machine or a CPAP machine to help me sleep. And I was incredibly glad to have that device available. I actually wound up wearing it, you know, during the day for chunks of the day where I felt like I was having trouble breathing. And it definitely felt like it made a difference. I'd say after a couple of weeks, it started to improve, but slowly. Go ahead.
So one question about your chest x-ray, did they see the typical kind of ground glass thing in your lungs that they talk about? Or
I think so. I think, you know, the main thing that my physician reported to me was the fluid in my lungs, which I don't know I don't know if that's common or not. I would say I was a little unusual in that I really didn't have any other symptoms. I didn't have the loss of taste or smell, any of the gastrointestinal symptoms that are commonly reported. I really, you know, as far as I can recall, didn't really have any of that.
Matt, I was wondering, I have several friends who had been infected with COVID, and they both said their first reaction when the symptoms first appeared was denial. Did you experience that kind of thing? They said that it was a struggle to get out of the denial and accept that they needed to do something.
So for me, I'd say it was probably my first reaction was surprise. I was definitely not expecting to have it because my contact with others had been so limited. And we can talk in a little bit about, you know, what that was, but it was really quite minimal. You know, as far as I can tell, you know, I probably wound up getting it from a very brief interaction or relatively brief interaction. And we can talk about that in a minute. But I would say, you know, probably my main emotion was fear. We'll talk a little bit about some of the other symptoms that I had, but really the biggest problem, my biggest worry was that it would get worse. Obviously I've been hearing all the stories, everything that was going on in the media with so many other people. You know, I'm 53, so I'm not on the younger end. Am I 53? Sorry, I'm 52. you know, I'm not on the younger end, so I didn't feel like I was in relatively low risk. You know, if I were older, I would definitely have been significantly elevated. I don't have I don't have any significant underlying health issues, and I'm in generally quite good health overall. So I didn't really know what to expect, but I did know that it could get worse. And because, you know, this was in June, you know, the healthcare facilities were still very much learning how to manage the symptoms. And that I did know that by and large, I probably would not be able to be visited in a hospital. Just the idea that I'd be in that situation was definitely very, very frightening. And so I'd say that was probably the main thing. I guess, you know, I would say it was really more surprise than denial. I mean, I'd had a test, and I believed the test. My wife and a lot of my friends have worked in the genetics field and in microbiology, and I knew that the test, you know, used PCR, polymerase chain reaction, and I, you know, and was likely to be quite accurate, at least in terms of a positive. You know, if I got a negative, there might be a false negative, but, you know, positive I felt was very likely to mean I actually did have it. So I don't think I really had a lot of doubts that that I had it. You know, I was worried for my family. I'd say, you know, one of our first decisions was how much I should quarantine within our home.
And your wife never caught it from you, correct?
Never did. Now, you know, the listener should check the statistics themselves. But my recollection is that actually the transmission rate within a household is highly variable. You know, I'm far from an expert, but my understanding is that, you know, how infectious you are varies a lot from person to person when you have it. And that, you know, that my understanding is that's why you get some folks who are super spreaders and some people like myself who never give it to their spouse. Now, you know, by the time I was showing symptoms, I probably had been exposed, you know, a week before that. And so I was probably infectious for, you know, 3, 4, 5 days at least. But yeah, my wife, who obviously I live with in the same home and same bedroom, never got it. In fact, she had, two negative, nasal swabs and a negative antibody test. So although it's certainly possible that those are all false negatives, probably more likely that she just, you know, we were lucky and she was just never infected.
Yeah, I mean, my daughter had COVID and neither her husband nor her daughter, who was living in the household with him at the time, caught it from her. So it's kind of mysterious, you know. And the idea of the super spreader is, I think that's fairly recent thinking, but it really does seem that people with COVID, though they may be somewhat infectious, are not necessarily as infectious as a super spreader who can show up at an event, for instance, and infect a lot of people.
So, I mean, I was not, like, I did not have coughing particularly. So in my case, it was mostly tightness in my chest, shortness of breath, but I really had very little coughing until later when things started to heal and, you know, kind of the gunk in my lungs started coming out. So My guess is by the time I, you know, when I was coughing, I was very likely not contagious anymore. And actually, you know, my family had a discussion about whether, you know, and or in what way I should quarantine within the house. And after talking to our physician and sort of having discussion internally, we made the decision that everyone in the house had already probably been exposed quite a bit. And I was probably nearing the end of my infectious period. And that, you know, we felt we'd already rolled the dice. And we weren't going to really take any particular additional measures. And whether or not that was the right decision is the one we made, and it wound up being pretty much okay.
So let's get back to the question of the actual exposure, you know, what made you sick. Have you zeroed in on any possible source of exposure that you really think was likely?
Well, I mean, it's probably one of three things because, I mean, obviously this was something I thought about a lot afterwards because I'd been extremely careful. And, you know, as I mentioned, as an information worker, I'm privileged to be able to earn a living without leaving my home. And there are, of course, many millions of people who aren't in that position. I would say it probably, you know, as far as I know, it was one of three things. The first is that, you know, I was going to the grocery store, although we did do curbside pickup and delivery primarily. There were a few things that I wanted to get at the store. So I did go to the store and I was careful, but of course, none of those measures are perfect. And so that's the first possibility is going to, you know, HB or one of the other local grocery stores. I wouldn't say I went many times, but I went a few, and that's certainly one possibility. The second possibility is that one of my son's friends had a birthday and they decided to have a small outdoor gathering in their front yard. So my son and I rode our bikes over to the friend's house, and you know, I stood around in the front yard while the kids hung out with each other.
Were people wearing masks at that event?
Not all of them. Some were, some weren't. I think it was outdoors. People were keeping pretty good distance from each other. So in that case, I think either, it's possible I got it there. It's also directly, it's also possible that my son got it and it was asymptomatic and gave it to me. That's also a possibility. And I'll almost certainly never know the truth. And then the third possibility, which I think is probably the most likely, is that, you know, for, you know, like a lot of information workers, we have folks that come in to help clean our home every once in a while. And for months, we decided that we would continue paying those folks and clean the home ourselves. And in hindsight, I didn't think it through as fully as it probably I should have. But after a while, we sort of decided, okay, they were asking if they could come, they could come. And we were doing fine, but, it's a little hard to remember exactly the mental process we went through, but we just decided, okay, well, maybe we can go out and they can come and do some cleaning. They can feel like they're working. The relationship will feel a little bit less like charity. Not that we don't, wouldn't have been okay with that. But, so we decided that we would do that. And, we sort of passed each other on our way out and they were on their way in. And, about a week later, they were also positive. So they were positive around the same time we were. So, you know, I think it's probably the most likely that either we gave it to them or they gave it to us. And, their profession, their job requires them to be around other people, be in other people's homes. They have larger families. So it's also, I'd say it's probably more likely that they gave it to us, but I'll never know. And it's certainly possible that we gave it to them. As far as I know, we've still seen them and they came through just fine. As far as we know, no one else in their family had a very serious case. So I'm very grateful for that. And so I believe that that's probably the likely mode. But like I said, I'll probably never know. And it's not something that I really dwell on at this point.
Matt, I've noticed in speaking to various people that I know in various walks of life that they had different approaches to staying safe. Some were actually obsessive, I mean, to a crazy degree. Others were just following the directions. And then there were others who were just noncommittal, and some others that were violently opposed to any measures. And sadly, that related to their political beliefs. What, as someone who has experienced this, how would you address those people who ignore the common sense measures you could take?
That's a really good question. To some extent, I think that's a little bit beyond my own personal experience. But, virtually everyone that I personally know has been taking common sense measures. But, clearly we live in a very compartmentalized and divided country. And my experience is probably not representative of that of a lot of other Americans. I guess what I would say is that, this is an experience where we're all very closely interconnected, whether we individually want that to be the case or not. And I think there's a lot of room for difference of opinion on, you know, how the balance between personal responsibility and collective action. But I think when it comes to a pandemic, there are a lot of folks who are being impacted by our individual decisions who never signed up for the consequences of those decisions that we each individually make. And I think that that's unusual. Obviously, there are plenty of situations where the decisions that we make as individuals impact others. You know, the decision whether to, you know, all the way from, you know, driving while intoxicated to, you know, the choices we make in what we choose to buy, what we choose to do, all the individual choices we make. But I think, you know, pandemic, because there's so many nonlinear effects, you know, where everybody being cautious can have a greatly disproportionate positive impact, and everyone being uncautious can have a greatly disproportionate negative effect on our entire society. You know, the virus doesn't have any political beliefs one way or the other. It just, you know, it's a strand of RNA, and that's all it is, right? It replicates or it doesn't replicate. The meme of the honey badger don't care, right? The coronavirus don't care. It's not even completely alive. So I think, what I would say is, that, you know, the decisions that more than almost any other decisions that we've made in our lifetimes, the choices that we make with respect to this virus impact others in a incredibly major way. And so I think, you know, for my fellow Americans that believe themselves to be caring and to to want to live up to the ideals of supporting each other and respecting and wanting to protect our fellow Americans, I'd say, you know, find a balance that is appropriate for you. I think, you know, in general, the guidance that's been coming out of the public health professionals has been, you know, start in early stages of the pandemic when the least amount was known, the recommendations were the most cautious. And as more and more has been learned about the transmission, about the course of the disease, that the recommendations become much more targeted. And so I think it is possible now that we know more, right? Like as the uncertainty has decreased and the information has increased as well, not just about the transmission of the virus, but how to manage the symptoms. I think, the danger, although still very high, is lower than it was early on when we knew very little. So yeah, I mean, I guess I would urge everyone to think about the folks that didn't sign up for your decisions. Obviously, like many of us, I've read a lot of individual stories of situations of how people have gotten the virus and how people have wound up in the hospital or unfortunately dying. And in many cases, it started with someone who would not have intentionally chosen to do something that leads to someone else's death. They really didn't think that it would happen. I'd like to think that most of the folks that make those choices are either dealing with the fatigue and the incredible difficulty of the isolation and the change in your daily life that some people are just more capable of accommodating than others. I think other folks just don't realize the impact of the decisions that they make. You know, humans, as we all know, are not particularly good at evaluating risk in a typical situation. But in a situation where the impact of the choices that you make not only affects yourself and those immediately around you, but the people around them, the people around them, the people around them. I think it's naturally going to be challenging for people to make those decisions individually. So I really hope that, you know, the reason that I've chosen to talk about my experience online, on social media, in this context is really twofold. One is to reduce the stigma associated with it. Obviously, in hindsight, I made, you know, one or two choices. And, you know, obviously, in hindsight, I wish I hadn't done that. It would have been much better if I hadn't gotten the virus. But I don't think necessarily the choices I made were completely unreasonable. And so I think a lot of folks, and I've actually talked to a number of folks, including some folks in my extended family, who've gotten the virus and felt like a real sense of shame that they were foolish and they don't want to talk about it and they don't want to tell anyone other than the folks that they felt like they were directly in contact with and felt like they had to tell.
So they had done something that they realized that they absolutely shouldn't have done.
Maybe not, right? But I think, you know, a lot of cases, you know, obviously there have been many diseases that have come with a sense of shame over the last, you know, decades or century. You can imagine, you know, cancer, for example, you know, they wouldn't even say the word on television for when I was very young. Or people wouldn't even be told that cancer was considered a shameful condition. And like I said, it you know, coronavirus is a strand of RNA. And I feel like after I got the virus, nothing was gained by my not telling anyone. I felt like telling people and helping them understand what I had personally gone through could only benefit. That information in this case, I felt, was generally good for people to understand what I'd gone through and to take that into account when making their own decisions.
Well, and another part of that is so much of what we're hearing about the coronavirus is really scary. We hear a lot about people being put on ventilators and dying and so forth. And I realized at some point that it would be good to hear from people who had a more standard or normal case, because you know that most people don't die from it and most people don't get put on ventilators. And there just haven't been that many people talking about what you might consider a mild case. I mean, a mild case isn't exactly mild because it's difficult.
I'm probably more in between, right? I'm probably what you would call a long hauler. So, you know, my recovery has only been partial. So, you know, I still cough. I guess I really didn't finish the rest of my story, but after I had the fluid in my lungs, things got better bit by bit by bit by bit. And I probably got to, you know, 50% recovery after a month. I probably got to 75% recovery after 2 or 3 months. And I'm still probably, I would say, at maybe, you know, 80 to 90, 95% recovery. I still kind of feel like I have a little bit of almost like bronchitis, a reasonable amount of time. You know, like I said, I've had two negative PCR tests. I've had a positive antibody test. So I definitely don't have the virus anymore, but I'm still dealing with the after effects. And, I'm having to face the fact that, you know, it's possible that some of these effects are permanent or at least very long term.
Bodies can take longer to heal for some people than others, for sure.
Absolutely. And, you know, maybe as many as, you know, 10 or even 20% of the people who get coronavirus are going to have some long-term effects. Actually, I've been a member of an online community that I would recommend to any of the listeners that have had COVID and have some similar things called Survivor Corps. And it's a combination of a support community and a resource for research. So it's a there's a lot of threads on the Facebook group. There's an email list. There's a lot of resources. It's survivorcorps.com. And the volume is actually quite high. It's actually been a little bit challenging to keep up with everything. But they've done a really fantastic combination of collecting information from individuals spread all around the country who have had long-term symptoms, advocating for research and folks who have long-term COVID symptoms, as well as a source of recruiting for clinical trials and research for researchers that are trying to look into it. I mean, it's a very, the mechanism of the virus is still relatively poorly understood, although obviously we're learning very quickly.
Matt, I was impressed by what you said about not being ashamed, not hiding the fact. And working as a journalist in the Bay Area way back when, I covered the AIDS epidemic. And that disease did not start turning around treatment of it until people came forward and said, yes, I have it. Yes, I got it. Yes, my friend died from it. And the denial is the biggest enemy to people trying to come to grips with a serious matter. And I think it's great that you pointed that out.
Well, thank you. I remember those really dark times as well. And, in that case, obviously, there was a confluence of a disease and a community that was already heavily discriminated against in our society. And, luckily, there's been a lot of change in that regard. Both in terms of HIV and in terms of gay community. But I think one of the, I guess maybe we saw some of that in a somewhat different way in this pandemic, or at least in my perspective, because, pandemics generally start in more heavily populated areas where there's more opportunity for transmission, as well as with travelers, which tend to travel between more populated areas, and because we have a political divide in our country between urban and rural areas, this pandemic, I think, hark back to what you were saying earlier, this pandemic did have a stigma, a political stigma, because it started in urban areas, at least in my opinion. And so I think, that same thing that you saw, back in the 1980s, maybe to some extent you saw some of the same dynamics, and obviously in a very different way, but today. And so I think we can learn lessons from the sacrifice of so many people during that era. And, my small bit that I can have to play, I guess, is twofold. One is to help reduce the stigma, and the other is to help increase awareness. Go ahead, please.
There's one question that I meant to ask earlier, which was about, therapy, basically. What medicine were you prescribed, and how effective was it in helping you?
So there weren't a lot. I'd say the primary medication I was prescribed early on was an albuterol inhaler. I have pet allergies, like dog and cat allergies, and so I actually had one already, one of these albuterol inhalers, just for the the rare occasion when I would be staying with somebody who had a dog or a cat. Actually, those allergies have gotten better as I've gotten older, so I really don't use it very often, but I already had it, so that definitely helped. Other than that, there really weren't a lot of medications that were really felt to be helpful. I went on the principle of can't hurt, might help. And so I wound up taking vitamin D. I took Benadryl. What are some other things that I wound up taking?
Pepcid is, some people say that Pepcid is helpful.
I took Pepcid, omeprazole. And, you know, it was really on the, you know, I tried not to go incredibly overboard, you know, tried to, you know, eat healthy, although I generally eat relatively healthy to begin with. But
did you have trouble eating? Was your appetite suppressed?
That's a good question. Not really. Maybe a little bit at the beginning, but that may have been more my energy level. My understanding is that, you know, the virus that causes COVID, of course, not only affects the respiratory tissues, but can also affect the nervous tissues, the GI tissues. I'm just assuming, because I didn't have any of those other symptoms, that the virus was really limited to my respiratory system, and probably my lower respiratory system. And so I'm guessing that's why I didn't really have any of those other symptoms. Of course, I'll probably never know.
And have you had additional doctor's visits, or have you mostly just stayed home?
So I've had mostly telemedicine visits, just a regular check-in with my primary care physician. I've had one or two in-person visits. I did get prescribed during the recovery, I did get prescribed a steroid inhaler, which seems to have helped. But you know, there's no control, so I'll never know for sure. Apart from that, I've been ramping up my exercise. I've been doing a lot of walking. I've started running again. And although here, I'm going to cough again. Of course, I think to some extent it's a little bit psychosomatic, but, it's kind of like, whenever my kids bring home a note about lice, it makes my head itch. Every time I talk about my lung condition, it makes me cough. I've been kind of on the lookout for things that might help. But at this point, I've just been trying to take good care of myself, and I'm hoping that it will continue to improve.
So what have we not covered? Can you think of anything else you want to share with us before we end the call?
Let's see. One of the things that I would add, and I was trying to decide whether to talk about this too much, but my daughter, who's almost 12, did wind up getting COVID. And although her initial symptoms were relatively mild, she had a fever and had some difficulty breathing for about a week. She wound up getting an inflammation of her vestibular nerve, which is the nerve that connects your inner ear and your brain, and the portion of your inner ear that controls your balance. And to this day, she's been having vertigo. And I'd say, she and I were probably infected around the same time. Although it's possible that one of us infected the other, we were pretty much in the same places. I think there's a misconception out there that children are essentially immune, or if they get it, then they're not really going to have any lasting effects. My own family's experience is that's not the case. And so, having to deal with that over the last, going on 4 months, four or five, almost 5 months now, that it's one thing to take a risk yourself. I think it's another to take a risk that puts, your family, especially, children and, people who are older in jeopardy. So that would be the only other thing to add. And I wasn't really sure how much to go into that, because I want to sort of protect her privacy to some extent.
Yeah, but absolutely.
I think that's really important. And, since my goal really here is to increase awareness, it's just something to think about.
Yeah. Well, and vertigo is quite annoying. I've experienced that myself, just benign positional vertigo. So I'm sure that it's been difficult for her. Is she recovering pretty well now?
It's kind of similar to me, right? I mean, it's gotten better, but it's a little by little thing. partly it's about retraining your brain, what the normal set of signals are from your vestibular balance system. And you know, that's not something that happens overnight. Also, you know, nerve tissue takes a lot longer to heal from inflammation than a lot of other tissues in the body. So, I would recommend one other piece of online media. I think, I mentioned Survivor Corps. There's a fantastic video, on YouTube. Let me see if I can find it. Maybe I can share my screen here. It's by the Thought Emporium. It's called "How Does COVID-19 Testing Actually Work?" And Thought Emporium is a bio science YouTube channel, sort of like a biohacker who does genetics things sort of at home, sort of the equivalent of obviously there are YouTube channels about all kinds of things. And I thought he did just a really fantastic job of not only talking about how COVID testing works, but about how COVID itself works. Now, this video was made about, you know, maybe 2 months ago. So obviously there continues to be a lot learned since then, but it's one of the resources that for those who are somewhat technical, like myself, and I would imagine a lot of your listeners, I found it to be a really, really useful and helpful resource, and not just interesting, but just valuable in general.
Yeah, I found the video. I can put that link in our the documentation that we share with the audio.
That'd be great.
And we can also add it when we add this to YouTube, if you can think about that, Scoop. I did put that link in our notes.
Mm-hmm. That'd be great. That was great.
And I just thought of one other question, which is in many cases, there are people who are having symptoms that are more related to their immune response, sort of overactive immune response. Have you experienced that at all? Or is there anything that you could identify as being part of your immune response?
That's a good question. You know, I don't really know. It's certainly possible that some of what was going on in my lungs, especially, you know, over time, was an immune response. Obviously, anything that our body does in response to infection involves the immune system. So it's certainly possible, but I really don't know. I discussed with my physician whether to try some steroids, some systemic steroids. And we may still wind up trying that, but my understanding is there's kind of a delicate balance.
Yeah.
You know, do you want to suppress your immune system and reduce your body's ability to respond, or do you want to, you know, just kind of slow down an overactive immune system? And I don't know the answer to that question in my case. Probably we'll never know.
Well, thanks a lot, Matt. We really appreciate you joining us today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I hope we could have you back under less dire circumstances to talk about the other parts of your life.
That'd be great. I'd love to talk about the technology and the world and the rest of the world that we live in. So,
yeah, that'd be excellent. We will follow up.
All right. Thanks again. I really appreciate the opportunity, and I hope this has been helpful to you guys and to your listeners.
You can follow Matt on Twitter as @ZenCoin. You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.